There will be no personal nor direct attacks on anyone. And I would ask that you please try to keep down the loud cheering and the clapping. There will be no booing and no unruly behavior. With that,
this is painful, and it will be for a long time.
Donald Trump, baby! That's right, this man knows what's up!
After all, these are a couple of high-stepping turkeys, and you know what to say about a high-stepper. No step too high for a high-stepper.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Well, Sean's a tough guy. I mean, I think everybody knows that. You know, Sean, he took some licks. He hangs in there.
Yeah, what's wrong with the beer we got? I mean, the beer we got drank pretty good, don't it?
Did you hear what I said?
So this is a brave council. I had no doubt about them.
That doesn't suck.
If you don't like it, too bad.
Last question. Were you high on drugs?
Last question. Kiss my...
All right, away we go. FM Talk 106.5 and Midday Mobile. Glad to have you here on this Thursday, the Friday Eve edition of the show. Glad you're along. Speaking of shows, too, remember tonight, Thursday night, back out at Voodoo Wings. You have Tiger Talk and Tiger Talk Overtime. So we'll see you out there this evening. Come see us right across from the University of South Alabama. Now, you're going to see how this works. I'm segueing. This is a pivot and a segue, because right across the street from Voodoo Wings is University of South Alabama. And from the University of South Alabama, Dr. Philip Carr is joining us now on Midday Mobile. See what I did there?
You did great there, Sean.
Thank you.
You're making connections.
That's right. That's what we're about. And if folks said, go, man, I remember Dr. Carr. Yeah, you were on, it was, gosh, what, a month, 2 months ago?
Yeah, maybe close to 2 months.
And I called you up and started melting your ear down when these articles came out surrounding footprints found at White Sands, at the White Sands Bissell Range area in the White Sands Park, right?
That's right.
And this is, explain kind of, we'll do the short version of what we did last time to set things up. Why was this of interest, that these footprints that were found in the mud, in the dirt?
These footprints are of interest because the folks who study those footprints say these are human footprints. And when the people purported walked across this sand, seeds were pressed into these footprints. Yeah, we can date the seeds.
Okay.
We can use radiocarbon dating to date the seeds. And the seeds come back consistently at 25 to 27,000 years ago, and that is amazing.
That is, and I think we did delve into this a lot when you were on last time, how big of a deal this is, because we're not talking about splitting hairs here. It's not like the previous assumption of first human beings in the New World was when?
12 to 15,000 years ago.
We just doubled that and more.
Right.
That is really big.
It is tremendous change in our view of things, of how the North America and South America were populated.
Right. And we, you know, because I grew up learning, all right, got Bering Land Bridge, kids. Okay, so the sea levels were down because of the Ice Age. There was this land bridge exposed. People came out of Asia. They came across, and then they worked their way into the New World. Where are we on Bering Land Bridge?
That's a great question, and if we continue with that idea of the Bering Land Bridge...
Because that sets a time, right? We know the Bering Land Bridge was at this time.
It's only open at certain times,
right?
And if we have footprints of 25 to 27, it actually wasn't open right at that time. We'd have to push it back to 30,000 years ago when the people came across the land bridge, if they used that. Otherwise, we wait until about... 15 to 12,000 years ago to make that crossing.
But now, Dr. Carr, you have this, here was the old understanding, because this is when the Bering Land Bridge was, so that's when they would have come in and worked their way down. But now we go, okay, well, those seeds, carbon date here at twice that, but the land bridge wasn't open, so were they here even before those prints were found, down there in that Triad Lake bed?
That is the argument of some of the researchers, that these footprints are human footprints and that people came over circa 30,000 years ago. Now, there also
this twist is big to it.
It is big that were those people successful? So did they leave descendants? And so was that an initial migration that was unsuccessful, and that the Bering Land idea of, say, 15,000 years ago still holds for the first successful migration into North America?
No, and it's a good point that this idea, I guess, we need to think past that. Oh, yeah, well, if they came, they'd be successful. I mean, how many things, from weather to things that wanted to eat you to no food for you made it to where you might not make it.
Right. Potentially,
I mean,
try
to walk it now. Try to walk it now.
Yeah.
Even
right.
with walk, even with good hiking boots and you know some.
The Arctic's tough, right?
Yeah.
It's a tough thing, you know, with modern technology. It's
try to
tough.
Walk it.
It's hard to do. And if you're moving into a brand new environment, you don't know. The plants are different. The animals' behavior probably somewhat similar with the same animals, but the, you know, different idiosyncrasies of that environment. You're coming into a brand new situation. You have to learn that it may not be easy to keep everybody safe and fed.
Yeah, and if you get it wrong, you often don't continue to establish. So there might have been these pulses of people coming, right? But one took.
Yes.
One group took. It's the other thing I wonder, too, when we look at this, and I want to talk to you about we go from, you know, in Alaska, we go coming across there to finding people in New Mexico, right, those prints, or people at Tierra del Fuego in South America. We're talking about, I mean, how do you know to get, you had no map to say, let's go this way and let's walk for the next 16 years and see if we get somewhere. You just... You got. What about boats? You and I talked about boats.
Boats are certainly still part of the potential equation. And we talked about last time how Australia had to have been settled by boating technology, and that's 50,000 to 60,000 years ago.
Okay.
So there was boating technology in Asia at the right time. Are the people up in Northeast Asia,
like
are
Kamchatka
they?
Or
yeah,
wherever
yeah.
Up there.
Are they using that kind of boating technology? And you know, arguably, you could hug the ice shelf up there and not have to have a particularly sophisticated boat of technology to work your way down that coastline into North America and then eventually into South America. And there's arguments that the kelp highway, so to speak, that's what they talk about, that the sea mammals that would have been living off the kelp would have been really relatively easy to take.
Yeah. And especially coming up, not expecting attack from a boat, get them, and that's probably a lot of food. You get a seal or a walrus or something like that.
Exactly.
In. So, and that process then, however it happened, people walking down, you know, and there's a lot of things I've read that talked about humans spread on coastlines. It's a theory. I just read it. It kind of makes sense because you could only get attacked by a critter from one side. You know, if you're going one way from your left shoulder or your right shoulder, and there were lots of resources along the coast. So maybe the same thing's true if you're traveling in some kind of kayak or dugout canoe or something to that effect.
Absolutely. You know, the coastline, you know, so diverse ecotones, that's important for survival, because if something happens, I don't know, the walruses get sick or something on your coastline, if you have then the ability to switch to a different environmental niche on the shore, you've got backup.
You got food. Yeah.
So I think, you know, you asked earlier about that mobility, am I moving 16 miles? Am I moving?
Yeah,
I think it's that exploration of your environment when you have the opportunity in order to that mobility was your insurance policy. So knowing your landscape, knowing what was out there, knowing what was possible, so you're moving relatively constantly,
right?
So you understand what are your opportunities and what are your challenges.
I mean, we native cultures have been still nomadic, you know, there's some still today in North Africa, but I mean but 1800s here in the United States that, you know, there were people that were nomadic. You know, Native Americans.
Absolutely. Hunting and gathering
and
fishing has been a successful way of adapting to the environment for humans for the most of our existence.
I've been telling my wife that for decades, too, but she doesn't,
So we've been agriculturalists for, you know, to the past 10,000 years.
It's a blink.
Yeah, a blink in the eye of, you know, so for the previous 3 million years, we were hunting and gathering, and that niche was one that where mobility was essential to it, so that you weren't, you know, I don't think hunter-gatherers wanted necessarily to stay in one place for their entire life.
Grass is always greener.
Right, you know, and you've heard stories of other places, and there's, things to see, people to see potentially. So, and the other thing is we think population growth drove you to move. So if your group gets too big...
Yeah. And that's wild to think about.
Split.
It's wild to think about with the resources, because when we think population growth, at that point, we're not talking about millions of people, are we?
No, we are not. We're talking about, you know, so as a hunter-gatherer band, at least those have been studied by cultural anthropologists, you know, at the turn of the 20th century onward, you know, 50 to 60 people for most of the year.
Yeah.
And sometimes they break down into sort of extended families of 10 or 12 people. If the resources are dispersed, the people disperse to kind of map onto the resources during different seasons of the year. And then during a good season of the year,
we might all meet back up.
And we may get to as large as 200 or 300 people for 2 or 3 weeks because, you know, we can support that number of people in one place for a little bit of time, but then we need to disperse back across the landscape.
Yeah, it's like old college parties, and the coolers were empty, and everybody left.
That's right.
So in picturing this discussion, you know, I'm picturing right now, for some reason, I'm picturing the Pacific Coast,
mm-hmm.
right? That's kind of,
sure.
But we're talking about white sands. And then I want to talk about us here in Alabama. The overland, is that how they, I mean, how does that person going down the Pacific Coast decide to take that left turn and say, you know, we're going to go over this mountain range, and then we're going to go through, at that point, I don't know what it was like, but possibly a desert in the Great Basin, and then keep on going?
You know, I don't think it's... It's not individuals and necessarily making those decisions to make big moves. It's settling in a place, sending out maybe 2 or 3 people to go explore at certain times, and they might find a great place to camp, a great place to hunt, a mm-hmm. great place to gather, bring the entire group over there. We set up camp. Then maybe we start exploring from there, and we begin to understand our landscape and what our opportunities are. And then when our population does grow because we're doing well, then we're going to split into 2 different bands,
right?
And one's going to go to this area, and one's going to, you know,
that
stay in the tradition.
Over, but hundreds of thousands of years.
Yes, so that's how the world essentially became populated by humans.
Now, okay, so we're looking at this, that people spread out, they go, the cultures change, right? I mean, you have very specific identities with Native American cultures,
right?
They may have, you know, genetically, it may be all connected back to the same group, but they, you know, the same thing for Europeans, same thing for Africans.
Absolutely.
You get all these different cultures, but you go back, we all kind of came, you know, like, y'all, we're not so different.
We aren't so different.
Yeah.
You know, biologically, we share more genetics than we differ across, you know, in terms of percentages and so forth. But culturally, when we become isolated culturally, then we have this opportunity for innovation, change, and, you know, we get language change.
Mm-hmm.
If you ever go back to try to write, reading Shakespeare is not easy,
it's
right?
Hard,
it's not
right.
that long
old
ago.
Old English, yes. High German, Old English, all that stuff.
That is hard to do because
yes.
we've changed over that time period, and we don't necessarily, we're not thinking about the change. We don't notice the change, per se, as individuals during our lifetime. When you look over at a cumulative,
right.
there's change.
That's for sure. All right, we're gonna run the break in a second. Before we do, I got some question. I'll ask this one quickly here. So, a question: what type of seeds were they that they found in those prints? Do you know?
That's a great question. You know, I'm not sure. I did not read the work that closely to know
right.
the types of seeds that were found there. That's something I could certainly look into. It just didn't stick in my mind.
And also, just as we get a break too, you said, because, you know, the reason we first talked is about this find at White Sands, and you said you were speaking to colleagues at the Southeastern Archaeological Conference who were skeptical of the White Sands footprints, which I like skepticism. Not skepticism for just being a jerk, but skepticism is what drives, you know, truth.
It does. You're right. So, you know, challenging someone's assertion and having them support that assertion, that's what moves science forward, or one of the ways that science mm-hmm. can move forward. So they are skeptical that these footprints are actually human.
Okay.
So they accept that the seeds were in these prints. They accept the radiocarbon dates. But if the footprints aren't human, there's not something. It's you know, just another set of footprints.
Okay, then, and I'm the uneducated one here on this, but I look at pictures. I bring up something here while we're talking. They look. Are they saying they're not human? They're not Homo sapien, or they're not? I mean, they sure look like people's footprints.
And this, they suggest that some of the images that you're seeing are post excavation, and did the excavators, in assuming that they're human footprints, make them look more human? So that when you look at the
bias,
raw,
a bias when you're dusting, like, do y'all really do that? Like, the dusting it off, like we see in the movies
we
as archaeologists?
We rarely use paintbrushes and have the National Geographic music.
You don't have the hat, the fedora?
No, we don't have that.
Okay. I was just wondering, but yeah, so you're saying some inherent bias, maybe, if you thought, it's really interesting, if you thought that you were, put it in some Sullivanese, if you thought you're fixing to see a human footprint, the work you did to excavate it would make it want to come out more as a
human.
Wow, what's the thing my kids say? Mind blown? We'll be right back. More with Dr. Philip Carr from the University of South Alabama, anthropologist. We're talking about human beings in the new world. And we're going to come around to our state here in Alabama. We got a pretty deep history of that, too. When do people get here? We'll talk about it when we return.
Is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Right, 125, FM Talk 106.5, Midday Mobile. Continue our conversation with Dr. Philip Carr, University of South Alabama. And also, let's talk about, if somebody's listening to us, interested in the programs at South Alabama, you'll have some events for us to come out and kind of see what it's all about, right?
We do, so...
We get that music, National Geographic music, and we get the fedora, and we get the...
Well, not exactly, but the USA Archaeology Museum on campus is open Tuesday through Friday from 9 until 4, and then some Saturdays. So check out our Facebook page. So we'll have special events on Saturdays where we're open to the public and invite people to come to campus. Right now we have a traveling exhibit or a temporary exhibit on 50 years of USA archaeology, and our permanent exhibit tells you how archaeologists know what they know.
Very good. Also, I'm going to direct you all when we post the podcast and links up for our interview. Maybe we'll just put the picture up on its own as well. So Dr. Carr brings a spear in with a Clovis point, knowing that I'm a sucker for a Clovis point, a reproduction spear. This is an incredible piece of handicraft here, whoever did this.
So this was a friend of mine who is a avocational archaeologist, is interested in archaeology, and a flint knapper who is very, very skilled at manufacturing Clovis points and other stone tools. And we talked about, I sort of lamented. I describe what hunting a mammoth might be like in class, but I don't feel like I really convey it well. And he said, well, would a spear help with that? And I said, oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So we talked about doing that. So he made it a socketed end because we talked about, if you're hunting a mammoth and you're throwing a spear at, mammoth hide is going to be similar to elephant hide today. Mm-hmm. So you throw a spear
at
an elephant.
With a bunch of fur on it, too.
Right, so with a bunch of fur. Yeah. It's not going to penetrate. Right. You don't have enough. So you're going to have to go in and, with a killing blow, thrust up maybe in the belly or the neck of that mammoth. So you're going to leave then that socketed in, that Clovis point, into the body to help bleed that animal out.
And then the rest of the spear comes out, leaving that point.
Right. You get to pull the rest of the spear out and maybe reload.
Yeah, I'd run for a while. I'd run.
And, you and me both.
Yeah, I'd run, then come back and get him when he's looking the other way. You mentioned Clovis, too, and we got just a couple minutes here before we go to the news. But, I started thinking about, too, our picture. My picture is not being an anthropologist, but thinking about the country. Hotspots. I think about these civilizations, places like Clovis, or places, because that's where we've found the points. That's where we found the napping. We found the bones and the mastodon that had the scarring from being stabbed. But that probably was going on everywhere. It's just only preserved at certain places.
That's right. So the archaeological record certainly is scant, and so many things don't preserve in it. So that's why it's so fantastic when we find evidence. I mean, think how many footprints there have been made across the country, and we've got to have a handful from 27,000 years ago is incredible, but that goes for all sorts of evidence. So the archaeological evidence is decomposes, and so we take what we can to try and then make inferences about what life was like in the past.
All right, and as we go to news here, we'll come back. I want to talk about Alabama, too, because thinking about that, like, things are preserved in drier climates better than more humid climates. I know the climate's always not been the same here, but, like, give us an idea. If we're looking at, 25,000 years on this one discussion, when can we say for sure there's a human being in Alabama? What we consider, our area now.
So stone tools are our evidence when we go back at most places 25,000 years ago, because that survives. And then it becomes, do we have stone tools in a sealed context that has plant remains or burnt plant remains, carbon that we can date? And then based on those two things being associated, that stone tool dates to 25,000 years ago.
When do we have, what's that date in Alabama?
In Alabama, we don't have good Clovis points in context with radiocarbon dates. They're mainly surface finds in North Alabama around a raw material source called Fort Payne chert.
The chert? C-H-E-R-T.
That's right. So that's what they made their stone tools from. Sometimes they would have called it flint, but in the geologists in North America call it chert. It's okay. A cryptocrystalline.
When we come back, I want to talk about that time period and how this all plays out in the state of Alabama. Dr. Philip Carr, our guest.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
All right, welcome back. FM Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile. By the way, it's not a find that's very old. It's only it's less than a year old when we launched the FM Talk 106.5 app. It's pretty fresh. If we do the radiocarbon dating on that app, you'll be able to find out. It's been around for less than a year, but we'd love you to download it. The first place our podcast posts, I've been talking about this lately too, when somebody's bothering me on social media, when's that podcast going to post? The first place it posts is to our app. It's the fastest. Then it shows up at iTunes and Stitcher and our website, fmtalk1065.com. But another reason to download the absolutely free and new FM Talk 106.5 app, get those podcasts first. Just go to Google Play if you're an Android user, or go to the iTunes store, the app store at iTunes if you're an iPhone user, and get it. Just search for FMTALK1065. See your logo. That's it. It's a free app. Download it and enjoy it. All right. Continue our conversation with Dr. Philip Carr, University of South Alabama. And actually, we had a fun discussion we need to do another time during the break about, how you end up doing this for a living, right? I mean, there are all these, there's all these really cool jobs. We're talking about when I got to school at the University of Alabama, I didn't know that there were all these other things I could do. I was pretty much like, you got to do, go to communications and go to English, or you go to business school. That's like, I didn't know anything else.
Right. And so we don't necessarily always do a good job of thinking about a major and it as an umbrella, and that there's so many different career possibilities under that umbrella, so that you might want to work for the National Park Service and you can do that as a geography major. You might do that as an anthropology major, and you could do that as a communication major,
right,
potentially as well.
Right.
So all of these majors can lead into certain career paths, and it's trying to link what someone maybe wants to do or thinks that they're good at with where they might go. So I think universities are getting better at that, but back in, in the 80s,
yes,
when we
yes,
were in school,
yeah.
It was a little bit harder to figure out.
Yeah, nobody was offering me that back then. All right, we mentioned Alabama. We're in the discussion of the Americas in total, and it's just amazing to think about from somewhere up in the north, Alaska, somewhere to the Tierra del Fuego. But this show, and you and I live in Alabama, so let's talk about people in Alabama. You talk about chert versus, where you can take something and say, okay, even though you can theorize, that people, human beings, were in Alabama. What we constrain is the state now. What year, how many years ago?
We do have Clovis projectile points in Alabama. They're from surface finds, so they haven't been dated directly in Alabama, but because they've been dated,
and explain that surface
style,
find, not meaning what?
So instead of being found buried beneath the ground surface, they're being recovered on top of an eroding surface, so they're being exposed. So if we walk out here, we're going to find artifacts, so to speak,
right,
modern trash,
right,
on the surface, but it's not in a layer, so we can't then date it directly.
Gotcha. Okay.
But because if we go out here,
you can't carbon date.
We find an empty water bottle,
yeah,
that says Niagara Purified Drinking Water and has the company's logo and stuff,
right,
on it. We know that style was made during a certain year.
Sure.
So those styles of stone tools change through time. They change more slowly, but that Clovis style dates to 12,000 to 11,000 years ago, roughly. And we then assumed that we had people who were making those that style of point here in Alabama.
So 12,000?
Yeah, 12,000 years ago.
Yeah, the beauty of you know, in my world of people that are just interested in this, the disc behind a tractor has been a great thing for finding, you know, I mean, that's most of what I know and found points and those kind of things have come from either eroded riverbanks or a disc field, you know?
Yeah, and when you think about that plowing process, it even if we found something 2 inches or 4 inches beneath the ground surface, if it's been plowed up, it's not in an undisturbed layer anyway. So
right.
Even if you found it, so
it's been picked
so
up.
So the plow has mixed those up. So if we found a piece of burnt plant remain that we wanted to radiocarbon date, we could do that, but we can't associate the plant remain with the stone tool because they've been mixed up by the plow.
Yeah, they got jumbled up.
That's right.
Some of the fascinating things for me have been going into the caves here in Alabama. And we are lucky. I think down here we don't think about it because it's the other end of the state. But we have some pretty awesome caves that give evidence of human beings using them for many thousands of years.
You're right. And we do have a really dust cave in North Alabama, really well excavated in the northern part of our state, and has good layering. It is complicated formation processes of how soil builds up in caves. And, there's also the problem of things dig around in caves, mm-hmm. animals and so forth. So they mix things up. But we've got radiocarbon dates for dust cave that are going back 8,000 and 9,000 years ago.
So those people that were here did that. This is the leap here from to the kind of the historical part of it. Mississippian culture,
yes, okay?
Which is I think don't you think probably one of the biggest things to talk. If you talk about Native Americans in Alabama, Mississippian culture
certainly is one. Yes,
one of the top.
I don't know that I think certainly one of the most interesting.
Okay.
And, you know, they...
Artifact rich,
agriculturalist, mm-hmm. mound builders.
So those people, do you think those people were, like, we're looking at Dust Cave up there. Are those people that were in that cave then become the Mississippian culture here in Alabama and elsewhere?
So Mississippian culture, you know, we're going to put sort of a date on that, roughly around 1000 AD up until contact with Europeans. So yes, in a general sense, but, you know, we know something more about certain parts of European history and folks from Asia invading and moving in and, mm-hmm. and things of that nature and migrations and so forth. So can we say that the folks that were in Dust Cave, you've got direct descendants here in with Mississippian? Maybe not.
Okay.
Maybe they moved to the north and
then some other group came in
and then someone else migrated in. But I mean, certainly they're part of the overall, you know, lineage of people here. But that's great for us to ask those questions. It's really hard for us to answer archaeologically.
What's so neat for me to, and I use just in my, not that this is accurate, but in my mind, Mississippian culture, I take long-term history of humans and
yes.
bring it into the modern world, and that roundabout or that interchange in my brain is Mississippian culture, because we know so much about the culture because it was going on and it was witnessed and written about and all those things, but it was fading out. But it was, like you said, I mean, it was bigger populations. We started off talking about small bands of people going down the Pacific coast, but Mississippian culture,
hundreds of thousands of people.
Hundreds of thousands. Y'all hear that? Hundreds of thousands of people in that culture.
You know, and it covers the eastern woodlands.
Yes.
You know, so, you know, and Cahokia up near St. Louis.
Which is this, describe Cahokia. Was a city.
It's a city. It is. It is definitely a city. Palisaded parts of it are palisaded mound centers in Cahokia. And folks living within the palisaded walls, people living outside, and then people living outside that area. So there's
like people coming in and trading, coming in the long boats and trading and going elsewhere.
Absolutely.
And,
it's amazing. So the Mississippian culture had a large geographic area, probably spoke, you know, similar language, maybe different dialects, but they shared a lot of common ideas about how the world worked.
Right.
So that they, like you said, they felt good about trading with each other, felt good about moving around that landscape, but there was warfare as well. You know, the Palisade walls are up for a reason.
Correct. Same ones that I guess DeSoto hit, you know, here in Alabama.
That's right.
You know, it's serious walls. I want a lot of questions from the text line for you, Dr. Carr. And if I mispronounce these, well, that's what. Ask about Talahata or Talahata Quartz. Is that Tallahatta?
That is, yeah. Okay. So Talahata is...
Just like Tallahatchie over in Mississippi. Okay, Talahata.
So that's a geologic formation, and there is sandstones in it, and some of that sandstone has silica in it, and that silica cements those sand grains together so that you can make stone tools from it.
Because that's what this texture is saying, yeah.
Yeah.
Scott is saying that it's in Clark County where he's from, and he said a lot of points there.
Absolutely. Tremendous amount. That resource, you know, here in Mobile, we don't have any good stone to make tools from. Clark County is one of those places where you could go to find the stone to make your tools from.
Right, and the trade back and forth, too, you know, you and I talked off, you know, I've told you about places that I know off the record, places here along the river where not only you're finding, you know, down below the stone line for, but you're finding these stone points from the trade, and they're next to, you can see the carbon charring from where fires had gone on for so many years way underneath this dirt.
Right.
So, and by the way, on the Clark County thing, John now asking, aren't there some caves as far as south as Clark County? Are there caves there?
I have heard that. I've never been in any caves in Clark County, but I have heard that there are some caves in Clark County.
Time for exploring.
There is, yeah.
Dr. Carr, what is the biggest, this question here from Nick, what is the biggest archaeological find in Alabama, if you had to score it? What do you think?
That is a great question, Nick. You know, because as, you know, archaeologists, we tend to think about, well, what is something that we found that told us something that we didn't know previously? And I think, you know, this is a bit historic now in that we have lots of evidence for it now. But some of the work at Moundville in just south of Tuscaloosa, when archaeologists did excavations there and they looked at the distribution of artifacts buried with different individuals, and we're able to establish that the folks at Moundville had a hierarchy and that people buried in different places were buried with different things, and you really seem to have
like
an elite.
Kings and princes dukes.
Yeah. So the chief, and then maybe elites, and then commoners.
Okay.
And this was, you know, very different than we sort of imagined this, you know, this idea that Europeans often had, well, these are savages and they don't have a complex culture. Well, clearly then you have this political social hierarchy going on here that bespeaks of a complexity, and that they accomplished these wonderful works in mound building and in crafts that they made.
Yeah. And think that, so Moundville, so Mississippian culture in Moundville, and the mound, let's say Bottle Creek, that mound, same circa period, do you think, going on, that, or are they from different?
Great question. And the latest thinking is that it is a group of explorers from Moundville that founded Bottle Creek, that the artifact styles are so similar to those from Moundville, but they date a little bit later, that this is a splinter group coming from Moundville to settle at Bottle Creek.
So the same way that, you know, if our forefathers built houses a certain way, but you move to a new land, you build the house the same way, you see that culturally around the nation. So that mound building and what's there is linked to how they did it.
And the pottery making in particular, the styles of making and decorating your pottery, that is the same.
This is fascinating. Coming right back, more of our conversation with Dr. Philip Carr, University of South Alabama. And I'll get to your text at 343-0106 when we come back.
This is Midday Mobile with Sean Sullivan on FM Talk 106.5.
Talk 106.5 at Midday Mobile. Continue our conversation, Dr. Philip Carr, University of South Alabama. So, Mississippian culture, is it easier to study that culture? There you go. Is it easier to study that culture than others because it was so organized and they did so much building? And
so, you know, it's more recent in time and they had more material culture. They made more different things. So
more stuff.
Making pottery.
Yeah.
And the pottery survived. So we weren't making pottery 25,000 years ago or even 15,000 years ago.
Right.
Relatively recent innovation worldwide. And it was invented independently in a number of different places. So Mississippian culture with pottery, carving of bone, carving of shell. So these items, and they're more recent in time, so that bone and shell survives in the archaeological record.
Yeah, this, and we probably won't have time to explore this fully, but this idea that, you have this one Native American culture, and that's the only one. They're the progenitor the whole way through today until we moved Native American cultures out of their home. But that idea, and it came up in some political discussions about the where they wanted to return some federal lands to Native people, but they had pushed somebody else off that property as well. I mean, I just, to make things fair, if the way in my study, you do it from a science, I do it from a historical literature, but a lot of places, like we'll talk about, I'm very interested in the Sioux, right?
Okay.
Lakota Sioux, and the Plains Indian, right? The Plains, the quintessential Buffalo Hunter. It came out of the forest of Minnesota and Wisconsin. They weren't always there. They pushed another group out. They pushed Blackfoot out of some areas and went in,
You're absolutely right. That humans migrate, humans interact, humans fight each other and, take over certain territories. So thinking of an Eastern example, the Tuscarora in North Carolina are an Iroquoian group, Iroquoian language. So they were at one time up in the Northeast.
New York.
Yeah, the New York area.
Yeah.
So then they migrated down and they established their culture in an area and began to interact with the other groups that were there. So it's a very complex past here.
Yeah, people just, because we've started this discussion about human beings moving to another continent.
Right.
And populating actually two continents, three, let alone moving from New York State down to North Carolina.
Right. And you saw that, until the horse made occupation of the plains more practical, the most human occupation on the plains was along the river valleys.
Right.
So you weren't spending lots of time out on the plains itself because you didn't be mobile enough.
The fastest person trying to chase down a bison,
just not going to work. But I don't want to lose sight of the fact that in a sense, or in the grand sense, this land was theirs.
Right, but it's just this specific, I think this idea, it's almost like, growing up, there used to be the placemat maps of the United States, and it showed like simplified version, like Alabama is a cotton, is this, and Florida there's an alligator attacking, and there's, there's a cowboy in Texas, and everything. This simplified that it's only this. And I think we see that sometimes in the way it represents Native American cultures, they were there from the start, and they've never been anywhere else. And you go, wait a second.
The five civilized tribes in the Southeast, as if there's five, and who gets to decide who's civilized and who's not.
Right.
So all of that.
First one's in.
Right. So you're absolutely right. It's much more complex than we tend to present because, we lose sight. That subtlety and nuance becomes hard to comprehend.
Okay. We started this conversation about the information out of White Sands and this idea of doubling the length, possibly, or time period. Humans been in the New World. That's a sea change event. Now, it's still being argued. I love that. I want it to be argued to make sure we get to what is truth. But that still keeps the idea of the New World settlement. It changes some parts of it. We don't throw the whole thing out. Do you see where we are with science now and anthropology, do you see a further refining of a theory that we're working off of, or do you think there's some eureka moment out there that's going to throw all this out with the baby out with the bathwater? You see what I'm saying? Are we going to continue to refine a theory as we get new technology, new information, or do you think there's going to be a time when it all comes unraveled. You know, you wonder.
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, on the one hand, I think we you know, in some of the big picture ideas of when humans fill up the planet with people and migrate around it, and they did that as hunter-gatherers, that some of that won't be unraveled. But, you know, the specifics, you know, could we have had folks along the Northwest coast much earlier and mm-hmm. they didn't leave anyone behind so that there's multiple migrations into the world, multiple yes. migrations across the Bering Land Bridge even.
Could they have come, just start this trouble, could they have come the other way too?
That is an interesting idea. Genetically, we don't find that those right, connections from an African continent or from a European continent.
Right, it's Asian, but I'm just...
Could there
know,
be an unsuccessful migration from there? It's not impossible.
Yeah, and I'm not even thinking about the Native American culture here, but then it gets the whole other world of, you know, was it Leif Erikson? I mean, who's in the New World first, you know, on the European side and all that?
Indeed, it raises a bunch of questions. There have been some... archaeological researchers who've thought about it, put out the idea that it's possible that at 20,000 years ago from Europe, you could have boated around that ice shelf mm-hmm. and you would have ended up in the southeast quite early at 14 or 15,000 years ago.
Wow.
And that might have been the place to get out of the boat because you don't have the same kind of ice shelf and you've got an environment that's warmer and a little milder, and maybe that's the time to settle.
And there's food.
And there's food.
And there's food. That is for sure. All right. Remind folks if they, once again, want to come out and see what y'all are doing at the University of South Alabama, the regular hours, and then you'll have special events.
We do. So we're open Tuesday through Friday from 9 to 4, and we do that because school
Which
groups,
building is that? Like where?
So it's the USA Archaeology Museum
okay.
Near the chemistry building.
Okay.
For those of you who've been on campus, and you can get on our Facebook page and see about the parking and get some of those details. And then we're open on Saturdays for special events. Sometimes it's a walk through the garden. It might be story time for the younger kids. So that's a big part of what we do is working with school children. So we're starting to get some field trips again.
Good.
And we hope they continue.
Good. All right. Excellent. I can't wait to get you back in here. Your brain and your spear back in here.
I look forward to it. All right, Chad.
Dr. Carr, thank you very much. And before we go to Paul Fine Bomb Show comes on next. I saw an update here. Supreme Court has said no to President Biden's vaccine mandate. It is a little more nuanced than that, as Dalton was explaining. It is specifically on the just business side, on the healthcare side. It's not. We'll get you more details coming up, and of course, a full reporting on it on tomorrow's show. But it is no on the bulk of this from the Supreme Court. Remember, we talked about this several times, that this was the question of being arbitrary and capricious. Businesses that have 100 versus businesses have 99 employees. All these things go into this, and the Supreme Court has said no to the vaccine mandate. All right, more of that discussion on the way. Remember, keep us in your pocket, kind of, through the app, FM Talk 1065 app, waiting for you on iPhone. You go to the App Store, and for your old Luddites like me, if you got an Android phone, go to Google Play and look for FM Talk 1065.